From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on Business Radio, Sirius XM. This is Cade Massey hosting this week with my longtime collaborator, good friend, Wharton colleague, Audie Weiner. The other boys are out and about. Shane and Eric out and about. In fact, they're going to be out and about. Shane, for a while. You're about to go away, Odd. We're going to be patching it together as we usually do. Some combination of us are here almost every week of the year. Have been for 10 years plus now. We are recording this on a Tuesday afternoon, delightfully in studio, looking out onto, you know, it's not quite peak Locust Walk, but it's close to peak Locust Walk.
It's nice, and it's in the 70s today, and it's getting green.
It's a good time. There aren't that many great times to be in the Northeast in March and April, but this is one of those. That's Audie Weiner. He's going to be in here for the duration. We've got a guest in the second half of the show, going to talk baseball analytics, but not the usual. We're going to talk sports technology, fun stuff going on in baseball, even at the amateur level. It could be fun for the guys you're watching on TV, but also could be fun for you or your kids. Good fun in the second half of the show with an outfit called Diamond Kinetics. Between now and then, what are we going to do? See, what happens when Eric and Shane aren't around is that me and Audie are left our own preparatory devices, which might not be optimal. That may not be the optimal preparatory devices. So we went old school. What I've done here is it's like SportsCenter in the 90s. I've got articles printed out in paper with a highlighter.
I've got plenty of stuff I've been doing. I'm getting ready for a course, an entire one-week course devoted to sports analytics.
Well, this is why you're such a joy to have as a co-host, Todd, because I don't worry about these things. I know that I can give you anything, and it's going to be interesting.
We had the Masters this last week. I'm happy to talk about some of the research I did following up on our conversation from
last
week.
I just want to talk about the fact that a Texas Longhorn won the Masters again. Is that okay? Can we just do that?
Perfectly fine. You can talk about that.
Okay, that's good too.
Is that over now?
The tournament's over, yes. And the Longhorn part of the conversation's over. Scotty Scheffler, though, we had this text exchange on, what was it, Sunday morning, I guess, because Maddie sensed the odds around about Scheffler was almost even odds to win. He had a one-stroke lead going into the final round against a pretty strong field. Not that voluminous at the top. There weren't that many people within five or six shots of him, but it was a strong group of people. But it was about even money. And we had this exchange back and forth on what we think, you know, was that fair? We're kind of back of the envelope calculations. And we were not quite that optimistic. I hit up our friend Rufus Peabody, who I like to say is the world's best golf gambler, because it might be true. It's ridiculous to say, but it also might be true. And his odds were right on market odds. It was just a little bit below 50%. He made it just a little bit below 50%. And then Scotty goes out there, plays it close for, I don't know, 10 or 12 holes, and then just blows away the field on the back nine. Good to see. Fun to see. For what it's worth. When you're watching, what are you thinking of?
Well, you know, so I was interested in the conversation we had last week with Mark Brody about what affects putting. The course, the elevation, the angle, and of course the distance. And one of the things that Mark talked about was that everything basically comes down to distance. It's about 2 feet.
Not everything that comes down to distance.
And putting.
No, he says distance matters more.
Well, I wanted to get exactly the effect size. So the variation in elevation from worst to best, the variation in angle from worst to best. So angle, it took me time to figure this out. You want to be basically putting up the hill, that right on the hill grade is exactly the direction you're putting in. And of course, distance, it comes down to about 2 feet.
Okay, hold on. You're telling me that you went, after our conversation with Brody, and you
looked
went
at 100,000 putts.
I didn't even know this happened. Okay, cool.
100,000.
Okay, hold on.
Maybe 160.
Tell me again. What you're relating. And it's so funny to hear you, Audie, whenever you wander into a sport for the first time, it's so hilarious to hear you talk about it.
Yeah.
I remember you were talking about the World Cup in 2014 and you were describing the marauders running down the field. Okay, so golf is relatively new for you. And
never
played
a round.
Exactly.
Never played a hole.
It would only take you one round to realize, yes, you prefer to putt directly uphill at the hole, if possible.
But what's better is that my algorithm found it for me. I didn't know it, and they found it. And it had a bottom, the apex of the curb was right at 180 degrees, which is exactly at the bottom.
Nice.
And I had to call Mark and say, what does this mean? And he happily answered me.
Oh, my
He's so
God,
indulgent.
That's so hilarious. Okay, Adi, okay, now I'm with you.
But
tell me what else you find. Tell me what else
So
you
I
find.
Just corroborated what Mark told us, that distance, basically turn in the spread in elevation and an angle into a foot calculation. It's about 2 feet. Of course, not every foot is worth the same. The ones going from right on the hole to 2 feet back is different from, 12 to 14 in terms of the impact. But it turned out, I just roughly call it about 2 feet.
I'm not yet with you on how you're relating distance to break, and you're doing it somehow about you're saying there's the distribution of break. This is Goffer's reverted his break. Mm-hmm. The distribution of break. How are you capturing that?
And
how
it's
are
an you, angle?
But the distribution of the angle. So some are quite mild, some are flat, and some are very extreme. But across all the putts that are observed on the PGA,
every putt has a number. Your break number.
And what's
has
the distribution of that thing?
Oh, it's normally distributed.
Really?
Actually, the distribution, I don't even know. That's something I don't even... That shows you how bad I am as a data analyst, because I'm actually failing at task number one, which is describe your own data.
Exactly.
Incredible. But I do have that information.
Friends listening, don't do what Adi is doing. Friends, analysts, young people, don't do what Adi is doing.
So what's interesting is to figure out what my response variable was. So I'm not trying to figure out the probability of sinking. What I'm trying to do is figuring out the expected number of strokes to hole out.
Okay, fine.
Which is, I think,
slightly different.
Slightly different, but, and that averages at around 1.65.
I still don't know what units you're talking about.
That would be strokes, 1.65 strokes.
Now we're talking strokes, okay.
From the time you take your first putt on the green until,
Fine, but you were trying to relate the relative importance of distance to break.
That's right.
So that's and you found model. The distance mattered more, but you were looking at effect size, you say.
Yeah.
But we all understand distance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you relate that to break?
So basically 180 degrees was the best, and then about kind of levels out around 300 degrees. It can go to 360. It's not quite linear. It's more quadratic, but that's the top to bottom.
You're saying 300 is terrible, and it doesn't get any worse.
Doesn't get any worse from that on.
But hold on. Okay, fine. I'm act like I understand what all that means. Fine. So from 180 to 300, so you're saying that's the full range,
mm-hmm.
and now you're equating distance to some kind of measure about, as you move from 180 to 300.
About 2 feet in extra stepping back. The best to worst is about equivalent of two extra feet in the putt.
Oh, my gosh. That's a much...
Small. It's pretty small. Or you think it's big? I don't know.
Well, you're trading off a lot of break for a little change in feet. So
yes.
It really speaks to the power of distance. And so this was all motivated by the first question that Mark gave us before the show the other day, which was, which would you rather have, a side hill 6-footer
mm-hmm.
or an uphill 8-footer is what I remember. And we all said, well, because you're asking it, probably the side hill. But all of our intuitions are that we'd prefer the uphill. And he said, no. Empirically, now he didn't say what the exact break was. But he's saying roughly, maybe the average side hill 6-foot putt is more readily made than an 8-foot that's straight up. And that's because of the power of distance,
that's
which
right.
is really...
So the way I was calibrating the effect size was sort of kind of like the bottom of the range to the top of the range. Not the full range, but maybe 10th percentile to 90th percentile.
Okay.
That's
okay.
kind
yeah.
of how I did
right.
it.
Great.
And I basically corroborated what Mark told us. It was good to see right there on the... But also threw in the course differences. I had about 25 different courses.
Okay.
And this was the interesting... I know I did it on average, so there could be individual holes where everything is different, but
sure.
just on average.
Sure.
It's also about 2 feet.
What do you mean is about 2 feet?
So you can pick the worst course in terms of the putting
These
efficiency.
Are still PGA courses.
Yes, and PGA courses. And the best, and that's on average the equivalent of about two feet closer.
Well, given what you've just told us about 2 feet, which is that it matters a lot, it's surprising that the quality of the greens make that much difference. You're saying you're much more likely to make a putt, essentially.
At the very best.
The degradation in your expected mm-hmm. number of putts from top PGA course, set of greens rather, to worst PGA course, in your sample of the 25 courses you had, is the equivalent of a 2 foot longer putt, which is it counterintuitively more important than you think it is.
Yep. And that's that right. Now, that's of course the best to worst. It's not, that's the full max demand.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure that most of them are much
Good.
Closer to the middle,
yeah,
which
that's
gives
helpful.
Me another last finding, which I think is interesting, which is I looked at over 350 golfers. And I tried to see whether or not in one season, and you're getting between 100 and 600 putts, not putts, but holes for each golfer in my data set.
Okay. And so they some of them are a miss a cut. So let's say on average 54 holes per tournament. Let's just guess 54 holes. That's halfway, half of them making the cut, half of them not. And so 600, 700, so 12, 14 tournaments or something like
something
that?
Something like that. So I was looking at, I mean, and so it could be more, but that's what I had.
Got it.
And I wanted to see whether or not you could actually use statistics to say this is a good putter.
Yeah.
Or whether or not it's just the best. There's always a best and there's a worst. It's just randomness. Okay. And so I ended up using a technique.
Okay, hold on. This, let me just say that this is something that we try to do all the time.
All the time.
Not even just sports analytics. We really implicitly do it in performance evaluations and others, or other arenas all the time. Adi's saying, look, here's what he's saying, guys. He's saying, of course, we can just count up the number of strokes. We can even norm for the difficulty.
We do.
We can do all of those things, and we can rank those guys. And they will rank. They will rank from 1 to 500 or whatever you have. But that doesn't necessarily mean those ranks mean anything. That's what Adi's going to try to do. When he says use statistics, he means I'm going to rank them, but then I'm going to say, do those rankings mean anything? Because if we just ask them to flip a quarter 500 times, we could rank how many heads these guys have. It doesn't mean that they have difference in coin flipping ability. So Odd, now what are you going to do to try to distinguish?
So what you do is, and this is a technique that's imminently learnable, which is we're looking for what's called over dispersion. So if all there is just randomness, then that is a predictable amount of variability in all the golfers over the course of the year. We can actually just say this is how much variance we expect to see if all you're getting are coin tosses after adjusting for things like distance and elevation and the courses that you're actually on.
So let me hazard how one does go and help convey the intuition. You're going to come up with this. You know, let's just say it's the probability of making a putt, for example. Then it's going to be the probability. And so adjusting for all the factors, you might say the average putt's probability is 0.6. And now you say, okay, if that's true. And actually, you have that number for all your putts, so you can actually do better than saying they're all 0.6. You have expected probability for all of them. And then you're going to say, look, what if I just, rather than watch what happens, you know, generate a random number where with probability 0.6 or 0.7 or 0.4 or whatever it is calculated on that I've calculated, with that probability it happens just by chance, what's the distribution of performance?
A performance. So that's one way to go about doing it.
Okay, hold on, but you didn't tell us what you did. So if you did that, you would have a distribution, and then you compare that to the actual distribution, and you're going to say that—
You're looking for what's called over-dispersion.
Over-dispersion means
there's extra bit of variation, and that has to come from somewhere, and guess where it comes from? The players.
The individual differences.
Now, you don't know that, because it could come from variations in other things that I'm not including in my model, right? Because ultimately, what I'm trying to do is look at what Mark would call strokes gained from putting. That's the measure I used. How much strokes did you gain relative to what you'd expected to do given the conditions? And so what you're looking for is over dispersion. You want to see, are there players who are much better than you would expect it if you just tossed coins the way you randomized, or and worse? And it turns out there is a little bit of over dispersion, but very little.
But small. So one, how do you is it as simple as saying, what's the variance in the bootstrapped eras and what's the variance in the actual eras?
Well, it's even simpler. I do it without. I just use binomials and normality and what's a technique called empirical Bayes that allows me to.
Doesn't sound simpler, Adi.
Well, it's simpler in that I don't have to do any simulations, so I'm just using math.
Okay,
but I'm making some model assumptions.
Yeah, right.
But they're not terrible, not at all, because I'm looking at averages, and averages we know have normality attached. So without getting into the mathematics behind it, the simplicity means I'm not no simulations. You just have to do the basic math.
So how much over dispersion do you find? You're basically going to, when you say that, you're going to end up saying I'm attributing some share of the variance observed to skill, and I'm going to attribute the rest of the variance observed to chance. When you say that, like roughly, how much are you attributing to individual differences?
Well, it depends on how many observations you have. So if you have 1,000 putts, then I'm letting your own performance pretty much drive what my estimate is. But if you only have 100 putts, then I'm going to be shrinking back to the average enormously. And how much I do that depends on how much over dispersion there is. So where there's a considerable amount of shrinkage back, so there's a lot of There's a lot of much more randomness in the individual player statistics than there is in the variation in player talent. And so that's just the basic fact. And with a single season worth of data, you do find better and worse putters. But if you want to be certain that this is a really good putter out of the hundreds that I looked at, there may be two that you can say for sure. And I have to look them up because I don't know
that,
where they were.
That doesn't seem to mean very much right now.
So Brian Gay, he showed up. Am I getting this right? He's the best.
But
he shows up.
But you buried one of the most important observations about a paragraph ago, which was that the variation in actual skill differences is much smaller than the random variation.
Even
if Brian Gay is definitively and one of the only people you can say is definitely a better putter, that's still a minor advantage compared to the role of luck over the course of a tournament.
Oh my God.
Completely dwarfed.
Dwarfed. So just to give you a sense of the size of the effect, the absolute best putter, which was Brian Gay, and this is not that he had the best strokes gained. It's given his sample size and his and which was a lot, and the data that I looked at and the over dispersion, he turns out to be the here's maybe another one, but he had by far the smallest P value, adjusted P value. Very, very small.
Okay, so hold on. But that means more than you make it sound like it means. I mean, you're just adjusting for all the contextual factors and you're considering how many times we observed him. But I mean, you're still, that is your conclusion. You're saying that's the only guy I can say confidently is outperforming Chance.
And he's about a half a stroke per better than average per 18 holes.
Per 18 holes. I mean, that's so small compared to how much putting makes a difference
in the actual outcome in, of the
by
tournament.
Chance. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Adi, where did you get those data? How hard were they to acquire?
So I have actually two sources. So first I got it from something called ShotLink. They were sharing their data with academics. They stopped that. And I got some data from Mark Brody.
Okay. Okay. Great. Well done. And unexpected. Fantastic. All right. Let's hit a few other issues. We've got only about 10 minutes left. So, you know, I don't know that there's anything we have to talk about with baseball.
You don't have to?
No, let's not. Okay. I know your real passion and expertise is in hockey anyway. So
I know nothing about hockey. One thing about hockey that I care about right now. And
I'm
it's so
curious.
Trivial. You care of this? I've never played a game of hockey. I've been to a few.
you should go to more. They're fun.
I should. They are. In fact, when I was in college, they were really
so much
a lot
fun.
Of fun.
They're still fun.
And I've been to one professional one. But I just learned recently that for the first time in world history, a remarkable fact that you can actually field a really good team of Jewish hockey players. Can you believe it? In world history.
I didn't have a strong prior on that one.
A strong prior.
I'm not very schematic for Jewish. I'm from West Texas. And so
Airplane?
I'm not schematic for hockey or for Jewish. And so I guess I'm surprised by it. What is the best represented sport by Jews? What in major professional sports?
Well, I would say none of them. But baseball would be the one that has more than a handful.
Doesn't Israel have a good basketball team?
It does, but they're Americans.
Oh, is that the way?
Non-Jewish Americans.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
They have had some very good basketball players over the years. So but if you talk about representation based on population size, baseball would be one. Historically, boxing.
Oh, really?
100 years ago,
okay.
There were some excellent Jewish boxers.
Oh, interesting. All right. Well, I was not surprisingly going there with
the
hockey
were.
Observation. I wanted to just share that Connor McDavid, the Edmonton Oiler forward, who's played so well since he arrived in the league, he just had a 100-assist season. And we're wrapping up the NHL right now. 100-assist season. How many other players in the history of the NHL? This is almost as astounding as your Jewish team. How many other players in the history of the NHL do you think, Odd, have had 100 assist seasons?
Well, considering you call it astounding, I would probably say less than the fingers of my hand.
Yeah, you got it. He's the fourth. So Gretzky, Lemieux, and Bobby Orr. What
well,
company?
Well, that's amazing because those are three of probably the five hockey players that I would immediately list because you know those
come
guys,
up with.
Right.
Well, Gretzky did it 11 times, remarkably.
Well, there you go.
Unbelievable.
Talk about more standard deviations away from anyone.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so that's my one little hockey bit. We're about to get in the playoffs. We'll talk more about that.
We got
NBA playoffs.
NBA.
NBA playoffs.
I did run one stat, curious. I built a model that predicts your winning percentage as your function of your season-long plus-minus, which, as you imagine, predicts pretty well. And then I checked to see what the Celtics' final season win total should be based on their plus minus.
Okay, hold on. So I think you're working with something that's a little bit like the Pythagorean theorem.
That's right. Which is what the Pythagoras is. Yeah.
So tell us your starting place, which is in baseball, Bill James comes up with this thing. In fact, in some ways, it's like Bill's first thing ever. And it has great legs, right? People still think about it this way. So tell us what Pythagoras
is. So Pythagoras in baseball is runs scored squared divided by runs scored allowed plus runs scored squared. And that is maps to winning percentage. No changes, no constants, no nothing. Boom, there you have it. It's a great formula because it applies for small run environments and high run environments from 1880 all the way up to 2023.
Freaking Bill James is a genius in what he does. Okay,
but even easier is a formula that just takes the run differential and divided by the run total. So, okay. And if you just do that and then add a half to it and you get the winning percentage.
So the point of this is to say, look, runs are the currency of wins.
Yeah.
And that's more fundamental in some sense than wins.
That's right.
So let's look through wins and see what their run performance was. And so when wins really outpace Pythagoras wins, when actual wins outpace Pythagoras wins, we don't believe them in some sense. And flip it around, when wins underperform Pythagoras, we think they're going to, and this all should predict regression back to the...
That's right. That's how it's used.
Okay. So fine. Bingo. That's where you're coming from. Now you decide to try to apply something to hockey.
Basketball. I fit this essentially a Pythagoras.
Plus minus.
So it's just how many more points you're scoring on average than your opponent.
Okay.
That's all it is.
Okay.
So zero is average, and the best in the league this year by far were the Celtics at 11.4.
Okay, this is game level differences.
Average differences. So they're beating their opponent on average by 11.4.
Okay, by the way, what's the tail end of that distribution look like? Do you know? And are the Celtics just like a typical leader, and you look at the other end, and it's pretty typical losers?
Tell me the answer to that. Oh, he can't do that. Yeah. I'm not sure the answer. I think it's excessive. I think this is probably not the kind of thing you see every year.
They've had an unusual good win percentage as well.
Well, so they're 64 and. They're 64 and 18. That's what I saw. But they're predicted. Here's the punchline.
Okay, here we go.
71.
Okay.
Which means they've underperformed their plus minus,
right,
their Pythagorean, by 7 wins.
Okay.
Which means that they are much better.
Right.
And what their record
is. Okay, well, that's scary for the rest of the league. And you know, we were complaining, we should confess it, a couple of months ago about how some of the probability models out there rated Boston's chances for winning the NBA title. We thought it was absurd how high they had them early in the season, and they've continued to live up to that. And so the probabilities have only drifted up. And you're coming in and saying, yeah, I mean, with the simplest model possible.
Yep. And simple models have a lot of predictive validity.
They can.
And I'm not trying to overthink this, right? Now, when can it go wrong, right? So one of the things you know about basketball, looking at basketball data, there's a bit of a, there's garbage time a lot in basketball. Now, you can be using that to run up the score, and that could explain it. But usually it goes the other way, where you don't actually run up the score. You bring you let the score get closer.
That's right.
So generally, I always thought that in basketball, you tend to overperform. I mean, it's built into the formula. It should be. But this kind of margin seems huge. And if I knew more, I would... And I don't. I would basically say what whoever's saying Celtics has got it on the nose.
Well, I mean, you're without comparing to what things like the markets are saying, so it's hard to say. But I mean, let's just look at the odds, for example. As we approach, this is, I think we have the Western Conference play-in game. The first play-in game is tonight. This is Tuesday, so we'll have the real playoffs, if you will. The non-play-in matches, the series start this coming weekend. Going into tonight, Boston Celtics were plus 180 to win the whole thing at the top. The Nuggets, the leading team out of the East, out of the West, according to the market, not the number one seed, plus 300. And then, Adi, get this, where do you think the next highest team is? If those are the top two, where do you think the next highest?
Wait, so it's plus 180 for the Celtics?
Plus 180
and
plus 300. So Adi's going to convert these to probabilities in the head and realize and try to figure out how much left is left over.
A lot is left over.
Okay.
And are they? If they're treating them equally, it can
they're
go
not.
Down a lot. They're
well,
not.
Okay.
So I'm guessing plus 500?
Plus 12. So you're saying they are pretty flat. Once you get to that third, it's
if they're
flat.
Going, if they're going to 1,200, they're flat.
Okay. But it's a huge gap. I'm not used to seeing gaps that go from number two odds.
No, plus 300 is around 22-23%. Implied odds are exactly 25%, but you want to lower that because of the VIG.
Yeah.
And 1,200 is I mean, that's ridiculous. It's like four times smaller. So you're really dropping off.
Okay. And that's the Clippers, by the way. And now we've gone through two teams in the West before we even get to Oklahoma City, which is the number one seed. They're not respected as the young new team, essentially. They're not respected despite being the number one seed. Interesting. You know, in recent years, the NBA playoffs have been more interesting than we expected. We used to complain.
We thought that they were done deals.
Yeah, we've done the show long enough to have been through multiple stages of these things, and we're into a better stage.
Do you remember
for NBA playoffs?
When every season it would come down to seven games, and then the favorite would win.
there was a season
several
like that.
Seasons of that.
Well, and then we've had the opposite, where like the Miami Heat gets the number eight seed and then makes a tear through the playoffs. And we've got all these interesting teams in the play-in tournament. So, for example, tonight's game are the Lakers and Pelicans. Lakers just barely getting in there. Tomorrow night's West Coast. Oh, it's also tonight. The two play-in games in the West. Warriors. The Lakers and Warriors are in the play-in games in the West. And then you go out to the East, and it's Miami and Philadelphia. I mean, you could. It wasn't very long ago you'd think that was an Eastern Conference final, and it's the 7-8 game. And then, you know, Atlanta-Chicago, that's like a matchup from days gone by. But there's going to be there's going to be more interesting if the recent past is any prediction coming up soon. Okay, I just want to say one last thing about NBA. There was a terrific article by Jay King in The Athletic on Porzingis. Porzingis playing for the Celtics now. Long article about how he turned his career around mid-career after being traded from the Mavs to not the Bullets, but the Wizards. He was traded to the Wizards to play. You know, he's a postman. People really thought he wasn't going to get there. He spent some time with our friend Dean Oliver, who was a coach with the Wizards at the time, among other things. He has a coach focused on turning his game around, and he went from one of the lowest expected. You feed him the ball down low, the 7-2 guy down low, one of the lowest expected points possible to one of the most valued expected points when he gets the ball down low by changing his game, paying attention to analytics. I think it's a remarkable story of paying attention to the data and working to improve your game mid-career. Has me wondering what those stats would look like for me and you out in our career. What would you have to know to really sink in and change your game mid-career like Porzingis has done? So he's another reason to watch the Celtics. All right, that's it for the first half of the show. We still have a second half of the show to go. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Kate Massey hosting with Audie Weiner this afternoon. That's Dion Simpkins bringing us up out of the bottom of the hour. We are in studio. It's always more fun for so many reasons. Sitting next to Audie Weiner, looking through the window at Dion Simpkins and listening to his tunes. Y'all may not know our sound engineer associate producer is also a musician. He plays drums in bands, does things with actual instruments. And so it's always that much more fun to hear what he has to say musically at the bottom of the hour. We have a guest here to say something in the second half of the show. We have CJ Handren here. CJ is co-founder of an outfit called Diamond Kinetics, doing terrifically interesting work in sports analytics, sports technology. We had CJ many years ago, actually, first half of our show, 2018, CJ was on talking about what these guys were doing. We loved them then, and they're just doing more interesting stuff now. So we're going to get into that. It's all about especially baseball these days, but sports technology. And we're so often talking about what the pros are doing. It's fun sometimes to talk about what the recreational users can do, are doing, and technology is moving out that way. CJ is the perfect person to talk with about it. CJ, thanks for making time for us, man.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys.
So
excited to be here.
Well, we love what you did the first time we talked to you, and we love hearing, you know, a few years later what's going on. So we're looking at your feed. You're beaming in from Pittsburgh, I believe. You've got a wall full of bats. Audie is drooling as he's looking at the beautiful bats behind you. So give us some sense. We're going to hear more about Diamond Kinetics, what you started at, what you're doing now. You've got a couple of recent announcements that are really interesting. But give us a sense of why have you picked those bats to have on your Zoom background, your wall.
Yeah. Well, guys, you know, this probably – I'm thinking back to when we talked last, and we were probably just in the – beginnings of, at that point, trying to figure out how do we put our sensor technology into wood bats. And we'll talk about how that's expanded into now, you know, aluminum and composite bats for youth players. But all the bats behind me and another 20 or so on the walls around our office are all bat manufacturers that our sensors can twist and lock right in the knob of the bat. So actually each of these bats has a little hole in the bottom and a receiver. And it really was the beginning of, you know, kind of the convergence of technology and the equipment itself as it relates to baseball and softball. So they're all memorable for different reasons for us.
Remind us what the sensor in the bats are able to do for the user.
Yeah, so wireless Bluetooth enabled sensor that in real time can track all the positional, angular, and velocity, you know, data for motion. And in our case, we're obviously tracking with bat sensors the swing. And so we process that in near real time, and then, you know, we can utilize that data in a variety of different ways. And you talked about in the lead in here, you know, how things are certainly being adopted at the professional level and how that's starting to make its way downstream. I think that's one of the interesting things that we're spending a lot of our time and energy on is, you know, the use of data is very different for different types of users. And so use cases and environments that are applicable for a major league player or hitting coach or college program, it's obviously very different than, you know, how a 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old would use and engage with data.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask a question because even though I'm 57, I'm still about 12 in my heart. And I obsessed more than anything in life. Baseball was all I thought about when I was that age. And I would have died to have a bat like that. There was no technology, obviously. So what would a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old with a bat like that do with it? And how would they use it to get better, which obviously would be the whole point?
Yeah. You know, I felt the same way. I wish when I was a diehard kid playing growing up, and now I coach my son's team of 11-year-olds who are all kind of right in that wheelhouse. You know, at the end of the day, I think the data helps us in a few different ways. As a younger player, I think we're trying to understand consistency around the swing. Where are the areas that we can control in how we learn things? So bat path, you know, how consistent and repeatable we can make the swing and make a motion. But I think just serving data is challenging. I can't just give my 11-year-old a wall of data and say, you know, here you go. We've got to really, you know, improve your attack angle. And so the approach that we've taken there is very much integrating that with instruction, with games, with, you know, activities that are fun and interesting, but that you're learning along the way. So we do that in a very interactive experience for kids. It's very different than a coach.
Well, give us an example of that, because, you know, Adi and I would be fired up if you just gave us a statistical distribution of our swings, but most 11-year-olds wouldn't. So how do you gamify that, conveying that information in a way that helps them practice?
Yeah, I'll give you two examples of games that are in our app right now. So we have an attack angle game, but instead of just taking swings and showing you what your attack angle is. So attack angle means if you were swinging kind of up at the ball at impact, that's a positive attack angle. Zero would be perfectly flat, and you know, negative would be a downward path of your bat. And you generally want that on an upward track as you're coming through impact. So we gamified that. And as you take swings, the more swings that you get in the 0 to 10 positive range, the more XP and points you earn in the game, the more difficult the challenge gets to move into tighter bands to try to work on consistency of bat path. And so the game is actually driving how you change the motion and the movement to try to feel what a positive kind of attack angle or an upward swing looks like. Another one is called Barrel Speed Climber, where we just ask you swing over swing. Can you swing it just a little harder, a little harder, a little harder? And so you're learning how to warm up. You're learning how to swing with max effort, but you're playing a game at that point. You're not really thinking about those skills. So we're kind of head faking you a little bit.
It's amazing, because this is the feedback that allows you to get better. And it's just amazing. We never had any of this crap, right?
It's not even just the feedback. It's the timing of the feedback. I mean, presumably you learn immediately.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you try something, a little more torque, or you position yourself a little bit differently, and you get feedback instantly on whether that translated into the dimension you wanted it to.
Right. It's also like the answer to the progress that the pitchers have made with the instant feedback coming from the radar detectors that show you their velocities and their spins. Right. Now the batters can get instant feedback on how they're hitting. So.
And of course, we're talking about the democratization of that because in a bat.
That's
right. 11-year-old can lug to practice right. and start swinging. It's just unbelievable. But Chad, CJ, tell us more about the gamification. And I mean, this is dropping really down into the concrete details, but for like really honing these things. I mean, one, the way you describe those games, I would want to play that game right now with Audie. I would compete with Audie.
You bet.
On can we hit I can hit that 10-degree range better and more frequently than you can. And then I love this idea that you say, you start out with giving them 10 degrees and you're like, okay, now pull it down into 5 degrees. And that's just, are you giving them, how are you telling them, or are they getting like a, you can
is
imagine even like an earbud with a ting, or the noise tells them how close they are, anything like that.
Also, is it soft toss or tee, or are you just swinging in the air?
It's whatever you want it to be.
Okay.
So the sensor doesn't care. I think we know we see a lot of use off a tee in a backyard or in a garage. It's a little bit of everything in terms of how you get that feedback. So, you know, we've designed this to be highly visual and audio. So there's elements of both. Very video game centric or game centric, right? So in those real time swing environments in a game setting, we're not trying to hit you with too much information. We just want you to know, were you successful at it? Did you earn your way, you know, to whatever the next level or the next thing is that you're trying to accomplish? And then after the fact, we'll give you a little bit more detailed feedback on, you know, what you could do to do better the next time around. We also integrate that in with coaching and instruction. So if you want to have some coaching feedback, we have about 200 different, we call them guided sessions. So they're data-driven instructional sessions in the app delivered. You know, we just today launched the Spencer Steer MLB featured player content. So we have big leaguers, we have various different coaches in our app that actually are giving you drills and things that you can work on in an integrated way. So we don't just leave you at the end of the game, so hope you figure it out next time. You've got some opportunities where we breadcrumb you over to places that you can learn and get some instruction. And so you talk about kind of the democratization of all this. That's one of our biggest goals here, is that technology provides an opportunity to bring information at scale. And so if you don't have the ability to access a coach or a private instructor, or you know, you want the opportunity to work on those things in between practices or on your own, we have all those tools kind of at your fingertips. And when you think about a generation of kids who have kind of grown up, you know, in a mobile environment and a digital environment, they gravitate to it. They kind of expect it.
Yep. A couple of follow-up questions. One, you mentioned, you know, you can obviously get the readings no matter what the kid or person is swinging at, whether it's, you know, a tire or an in-game pitch. What do you see in terms of, I just had a question from someone about this. Do we know much about people who don't do as well in game versus practice? So y'all must have enough data now to say, you know, practice swings are one thing, but then some presumably degrade when they're swinging at real pitches. How would you characterize that difference from what you guys have seen in the data?
Yeah, you know, I think we're just getting to the beginning of being able to understand that. One of the things that's evolved is in the smart bat set that we just launched for amateur players are all now game approved. But that was right. Something that we all kind of as an industry had to work on. So I think for the first time, we're really going to get the opportunity to start to see those differences.
CJ, let me jump in real quickly and just underscore what you said. You guys have just launched with Jack Marucci, a brand of bat that has this sensor, but has been approved by all the authorities for actual in-game use, which is a real evolution. And as you said, y'all started with wooden bats, and now we're down with the aluminum bats that the kids play with. That was a big hurdle to get over, and now you've got it. But that's only been since like late year. Your announcement on that was like late 23.
Just a couple months ago.
Okay. So that's the setup. But then, how would you characterize what you know or what you think you're going to see in differences in practice swings versus real swings?
Yeah, and you know, we will easily be able to see and understand if the mechanics change. Those are the things that we have visibility to. So we can see if you have a different bat path when you have a game swing. We can look at consistency, game swings versus practice swings. We obviously can't. We don't understand every dynamic. And so, you know, if you have timing challenges, that's not something that a bat sensor recognizes. Although right, we will right. know if you tend to be late on most pitches. If you're a younger player who's struggling to pick up a curveball, that's not something that your bat sensor is going to tell us in a right. game swing. But there's a lot that we think we'll be able to see.
CJ, on this was my other question. When we decompose batting performance, what role do we think is finding the ball versus swinging appropriately? So you're really focused on the swing here, which is utterly understandable and has to be really important. But there are these other components, like you mentioned timing, but also just like where you put that barrel according to where the ball is. That seems like a really important element. Do we know anything about the relationship between those things or the relative importance in batting between those things?
I think there's a lot of people that spend a lot of time thinking about that. I think it's still fairly subjective in terms of relative importance or the mix. I think everybody will nod their head pretty clearly that the mechanics, the muscle memory, the ability to, you know, to make the motion as best you possibly can is an important part. Timing is undoubtedly an important part. Hand-eye coordination is an important part of it. And you know, relative mix, I'm not sure, but there's a recipe there, and you kind of have to have all those ingredients. Mm-hmm. We spend more time, obviously, focused on the mechanical side of things.
Just a question that has been bothering me. So when I was a kid, it was swing flat or even swing down, and now it's swing up. I think I'm catching it pretty much right. What made that change?
Runs, baby. Come
I mean,
on
no,
now.
But even in the, in, it can't be, even in the little leagues and in the high schools, is it, I mean, where you would imagine that contact is and timing has got to drive, is such more important because that's what they're struggling still to do. Is there a balance between the two, or is the up plane just the right? I mean, because that's the ball's going down. So if the ball's going down, you probably want the bat to be going up so they can strike each other on the same plane. But so were we just wrong? Was my coach in high school just an idiot? I mean, what? Explain that to me.
No, we run into this a lot, and you know, I think that generally matching bat path and ball plane is an accepted view. I think there's extremes. And so when you have, you know, I'll call it sort of extreme attack angle, extreme launch angle, and you see some of that making its way down into the youth game, that's probably too far in that direction. I think that a lot of this started by trying to optimize the ball flight outcome and the on-field outcome. So a lot of this was really being able to start, you know, at the professional level, being able to dig into ball flight data and understand, you know, working backwards from that, what do I need to do to try to create the most opportunity for, you know, positive impacts, extra base hits, hard hit balls that created bigger on-field in-game outcomes. I think you have to be careful with how that translates all the way down to the youth game. Professional player as a full grown adult is different than a developing 9-year-old. And so what you're physically able to do doesn't mean just because so-and-so does it as a big leaguer means that you can create and do that same thing because you don't have the same physical capabilities at that point. But I do think that, you know, data has helped arrive at some places of consistency in terms of generally what we want to teach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, this is not the only thing you guys are doing. In fact, one of the most recent announcements you've made is the acquisition of a video technology. Can you tell us what you're planning, what these guys do and how you're going to use that side of the business?
Yeah, we're really excited. We just a month or so ago announced the acquisition of a video platform, video streaming and highlight platform called Sideline HD. And Sideline HD is focused on being able to live stream youth games, primarily baseball and softball, but really across a number of other sports as well, and automatically clip and create the highlights from that game. And so think about, you know, a youth 12-year-old game that, you know, we all played in, simple as clipping your phone to the fence. You can live stream that so those who aren't there can watch it. But probably most interesting for us is, you know, the availability and the ability to use in-game context. So if we have video of your swings, if we know what your on-game and on-field performance is, we can connect that together better with instructional data, with sensor data, with the things that we know about, the things that we're good at Diamond Kinetics. And so we're really interested in the connectivity between game content, video, and statistics, and overall athlete development, and the loops that you can create there for athletes and for families. We think that there's a lot of exciting things to do with video going forward.
Okay, so CJ, it sounds great, of course, if you can capture and connect all of those things. A few years ago, I think I would have been deeply skeptical that, you know, strapping an iPhone on the dugout fence post would give you material that you could convert efficiently at scale to all the things you just named. Have we come along that far? Is computer vision good enough, and computer vision maybe mapped with other technologies? God knows what AI can do these days. Have we come so far that you're going to be able to literally just throw the iPhone up there and process the data a little bit later and come out with some stats and suggested coaching platforms, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, we're a lot of the way there. The front end of that is the ability to capture the content. So the introduction of 5G and enhanced networks and processing capabilities of devices and in the cloud, you know, was a step one. I think that where this is going is, you know, both AI, computer vision, and other sort of advancements in technologies are going to be able to allow you to do more with that content. And I think that's what we're really excited about. So is it a world now where you just set your phone up and computer vision is tracking the whole game and scoring it? No. And you know, there's a lot of challenges to get all the way there. But will technology continue to get more portable, more accessible, and do more of that? Yeah, and it's happening really fast. Because to your point, you know, roll back to last time that we talked, the idea of doing that was didn't feel close at all. And now mm-hmm. there are across, you know, our platform and many others, there's hundreds of thousands of games being streamed, you know, a year. And so, they're being done largely through mobile devices.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the market for that? Where's the richest market for that? The number of players, of course, accelerates as you move down earlier and earlier, but maybe the importance of capturing the data isn't as strong. So where's the sweet spot in terms of high volume, but also valuable insights?
Yeah, what I think is most interesting about video is that, like, there's so many different use cases. And so, you know, streaming a video and having highlight clips is creating memories, and there's fun things that you can do with that that aren't about performance at that point.
Okay.
Something that as a parent I'm interested in, that my you know, my parents don't live, you know, close to me and can't watch my kids' games. So the ability for them to be able to do that is unique. So I think the value is in different pockets here. I think from a performance perspective, it starts even at the youngest level, you know, the hard game. And so if I can help, I was out with a bunch of 11-year-olds last night. If I can help any of them get, you know, one or two more successful on-field outcomes, and, mm-hmm. and video can help me do that alongside the things we do in the DK app, then I think that's a win.
Mm-hmm. How do you characterize the amateur market at the adult level? Because now you're talking about diehard, you know, people who are playing in their 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. Those are diehard players. They might be geeked out on numbers in some way, and they can, you know, some of them are playing at a reasonably high level.
Well, they play softball incredibly seriously.
Yeah,
that might be something you're thinking about.
This is what I'm saying.
I've been to a softball game, men's, you know, amateur game, where people come with equipment.
Yeah, of course. And they're not all serious, but some of them are very serious. and is that one of your markets, CJ, and what are you seeing happening there?
It's not one that we have overtly placed a lot of energy towards. I would agree. There's a lot, especially in softball. There's a lot of activity, and at the high ends of that, there's some very, very, very competitive adult league softball. But we haven't done a lot there. I know we have people that utilize our products in those environments. It's a little trickier one to put a business plan around and a go to market plan. So
right.
We've been focused much more on kind of organized amateur kind of sub NCAA markets. But there's no doubt that there's a lot of activity there.
Okay. CJ, before we let you go, what's next for you guys? Are you just in the process of integrating these new firms? These are major acquisitions. Where are you organizationally? What are you thinking about on a daily basis right now?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we're very focused on the exciting things that we can do in the combination of Diamond Kinetics, our technology, our platform, and the Sideline HD platform. And so I think that'll be our primary focus. But, you know, if I step back from all of this and think about the next couple of years, you know, the analogy I'd use here is that we're kind of moving into the middle innings, if you will. If the early innings was when we talked back in, you know, 2018, it was really about kind of data capture. Can you get this data? Mm-hmm. And now I think we're in a place where it's the application of data. It's how people get value from it. It's the consolidation of how these kind of point-to-point solutions start to fit together in more thoughtful ways so that the end users of those, you know, have to work less. You know, why do we put sensors in a bat? Part of it is it's just you don't have to think about it. It's just right there. It kind of works magically for right you. It's always on. And so I think we will continue to try to put some of the technology in the background, have it work for you, have it be more personalized, and you know, try to connect some pieces together that give you a more valuable experience and just a simpler, easier experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We you know, that's a theme across the world of sports analytics. We've got so much capability now, but you've still got that last mile of getting it to the decision maker in some form that is readily accessible, digestible, usable, and, you know, simplification is like a big challenge. We got so many dimensions and so many data points now in all these different corners of sports. How do you get it down into something usable? I just love this idea, CJ, that you've got like this sound telling you whether the swing was right or not. And that takes it back to exactly how we actually experience the hitting a ball. Like, you know, from the sound of the ball, how you hit it. Yep. Same with golf, you know, from the way it feels. And so if you can provide the feedback that you're capturing digitally, the very precise feedback, you know, whatever the goal is, you can tell them by sound. It's just, it drives the learning down into a deeper level, I'm guessing, and makes it much more intuitive.
Yeah, I think you summed that up perfectly. And I think that last mile is different for each type of user. And I think that's what we're learning, right? It's a different last mile for a college program, for example, than it is for a family with a 10-year-old or 11-year-old that's playing different sports. And so figuring out that last mile for the audiences that you're spending the most time with is the most important thing.
Well, listen, man, when you want to start getting data on the last mile for the middle-aged softball playing crowd, especially nerd heads, you know, send a bat this way. We'll see if we can find some people to give you some feedback on that.
And if you want to design an experiment to see how well your product can increase velocity or something, we can help that too. I'll be a willing participant.
Just across the state, man. You can drive over, CJ. Drive over. Bring some equipment. Bring some equipment. Drive on over. We'll buy you a beer afterwards. All right, listen, we'll let you go. CJ, thanks for making time for us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Of course. CJ Handren, co-founder and CEO of Diamond Kinetics. We've talked with them before, but it's been a while. Pre-COVID, we divide, as many people do, we divide our time around here. Pre-COVID, post-COVID. That first conversation was pre-COVID. Glad to catch up with those guys. CJ Handren. All right, guys, that has been another week here on Wharton Moneyball for Audie Weiner, my co-host the entire afternoon. This has been Cade Massey for Maddie Datz, the boss man. Dion Simpkins, the associate boss man, right here in the studio with us, unlike Maddie, let me say. And thank you to you guys for listening. Appreciate your being with us. Come back and join us next time. Until then, enjoy your sports.